Welcome to this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, the chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event in association with Humanities West, which originated the idea along with the San Francisco Opera. We also welcome our online and radio audiences, and we welcome everyone to visit us at www.commonwealthclub.org. It's my pleasure today to introduce our speaker, Professor Vaget, speaking about the Wagner problem, flawed character, and tainted reputation. But I'm also going to introduce first Kip Crana from the San Francisco Opera, who will give us a little bit better idea about the topic and also the speaker and his reputation. Professor Hans Vaget is Professor Emeritus at Smith College. I'm done.
Thank you, George. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm Kip Crana, the Director of Music Administration at San Francisco Opera, and I'm just here to briefly greet you all on behalf of San Francisco Opera. Thank you all for being here tonight and for your obvious support of our ring. You are all Wagnerites, clearly, and we're very pleased at the tremendous response and support we've had for our ring project. It's one of the biggest projects that anyone can undertake. It's the fourth time I've been involved in a ring at San Francisco Opera and the fifth time in 40 years that we've done the ring. So it's something we have tackled often. And it challenges not only our company, but also our audience. And I'm glad that you are all participating in the extra activities that are involved in that. We've had a great group of community organizations that have been part of our Ring Festival, as we call it, putting on events like this one. They have included the California Academy of Sciences, the Osher Center for Lifelong Learning, the Fromm Institute, the San Francisco Conservatory, Mills College, Stanford University, the Wagner Society, the Museum of Performance and Design, Jewish Community Center, which had a very lively talk, St. Mary's Cathedral, the Contemporary Jewish Museum, which has an event this coming Thursday, the Asian Art Museum, and the Center for the Pacific Rim. And to that list now, we very gratefully add the Commonwealth Club and Humanities West, which is a co-sponsor of this event. And so we're all excited about all this activity on this very interesting subject. I'm now very pleased to introduce our speaker, who is the Helen and Laura Shedd Professor Emeritus of German Studies at Smith College, where he first began teaching in 1967. He's a distinguished college in the scholar, I should say, in the field of German studies from the 18th century to the present. And among his specialties are the works of Goethe, Thomas Mann, and, of course, Wagner, as well as music, history, and film. He is the co-founder, among other exciting activities, of the Goethe Society of North America. Without further ado, let me turn things over now to Hans Rudolf Vaget.
Thank you, Kip. And my thanks to Humanities West for this opportunity to present to you some of my thoughts on Wagner and be part of this really impressive communal effort to engage in so many different ways with Wagner and with this Mount Everest of the musical theater. However, I'm not going to be talking much about the ring tonight. My topic is the Wagner problem, and I'll be talking at least about some facets of that problem. Ladies and gentlemen, Frederick Spotts, in his admirable History of the Bayreuth Festival, refers to Richard Wagner as, quote, the most controversial artistic figure of all time. This is a bold assertion, but it becomes every day more plausible in light of the growing stream of strikingly contentious literature about this giant of the musical theater that continues to pour forth in books, scholarly journals, newspapers, and increasingly in the blogosphere. In a recent study, one author puts it unequivocally, quote, all books about Richard Wagner are acts of love or hate, often a strange mixture of the two. We get a revealing glimpse of what looms on many people's minds when they think of what I'm calling here the Wagner problem from a recent article by Anthony Tomasini, the music critic of the New York Times. Overtly to stimulate interest in classical music, covertly to call attention to himself, Tomasini sat down and briefly explained his list of the top 10 composers. Not surprisingly, he awarded Pride of Place to J.S. Bach and gave high marks to the usual suspects. Most noteworthy in Tomasini's ranking is his reasoning for his relatively low placement of Wagner. He considers Wagner and Verdi, the dynamic duo of 19th century opera, and in artistic terms, equally outstanding. He then continues, "But who ranks higher? They may be tied as composers, but not as people. Though Verdi had an ornery side, he was a decent man, an Italian patriot, and the founder of a retirement home for musicians still in operation in Milan. Wagner was an anti-Semite, was an anti-Semitic, egomaniacal jerk who transcended himself in his art. So Verdi is number 8, and Wagner is number 9. The argument from one of the leading voices in the field of classical music clearly demonstrates that when the discussion comes to Wagner, a lot more than artistic considerations come to the fore. What then is the controversy about? What lies at the heart of the Wagner problem? Today, reservations about Wagner tend to be expressed on the basis of his attitude towards money, towards women, towards Jews, and last but not least, on the basis of the posthumous linking of his name to that of Adolf Hitler. The Wagner problem thus resembles a hydra with four heads. And like the hydra of Greek mythology, this one too, it seems impossible to vanquish because its heads grow again as fast as they are cut off. Let me begin with some observations on Wagner's financial finagling. Wagner has been widely portrayed and is routinely condemned as an insatiable schnorrer who unscrupulously took advantage of the generosity of friends and patrons, not only in order to survive, but also to indulge his pathetic love of petty luxuries such as velvet vests, satin dressing gowns, silken underwear, Parisian perfume, and, not to be forgotten, champagne. Wagner may have come from a modest background, but as an artist, he expected to travel first class and to be provided with a measure of comfort, even luxury, as a means, he said, of encouraging his imaginative faculties. He explained this in a letter to Franz Liszt as he was embarking on the composition of Der Ring des Nibelungen. Quote, "I cannot then live like a dog. I cannot sleep on straw and drink common gin. Mine is an intensely irritable, acute, and hugely voracious, yet uncommonly tender and delicate sensuality, which one way or another must be flattered if I am to accomplish the cruelly difficult task of creating the imaginary world of my new work." During the first 3 decades of his career, Wagner had no choice but to go into debt. He did so not out of reckless enthusiasm for luxury, as some have maintained, but for the sake of the works he knew he was capable of creating. Repeatedly, he had to hide or leave town in order to avoid the wrath of creditors or even imprisonment. Just as his spiraling impecuniousness was about to engulf him, a miracle occurred that put an end to his exhausting and nerve-wracking bullet dodging. In March of 1864, upon turning 18, Ludwig II ascended the throne of Bavaria. The young monarch was besotted with Wagnerian opera, Lohengrin in particular. He made it one of his first orders of business to track down the composer and to rescue him. Ludwig canceled Wagner's debts and set him up in comfort, first in Munich, then in Triebschen on Lake Lucerne in Switzerland, and eventually in Bayreuth, where the composer built himself a home, Haus Wahnfried, and erected for the exclusive performance of his works a brand new theater, the fabled Festspielhaus. Wagner's relationship with his royal admirer experienced numerous ups and downs, in part because the composer was less than completely forthright with the king regarding his scandalous private life. This has led some writers to cast Wagner in the role of an egotistical parasite who exploited his young devotee in order to further his own goals, and in doing so, depleted the Bavarian royal coffers. In reality, the outlays for Wagner burdened the court's finance far less than did the king's passion for building picturesque castles and pleasure domes in the foothills of the Alps. Over the span of their exalted friendship, which lasted 19 years, Wagner received from the royal purse approximately 500,000 marks, 562,912 to be exact. In return for this generous but by no means astronomical expenditure, the composer was contractually obligated to present the king with the autograph manuscripts of what eventually numbered 8 works, among them the autographs of Rienzi and the orchestral sketches for the Flying Dutchman and Götterdämmerung. Their combined value today, if they were offered on the open market, would exceed Ludwig's payments to the composer 100 times over. The whereabouts of these priceless Wagner autographs, I might add, are unknown. A group of German industrialists bought them and presented them to Hitler on the occasion of the Führer's 50th birthday. Some historians fear that they perished together with a German dictator. Others keep alive the hope that they might someday turn up. Wagner's chronic impecuniousness was caused by a variety of factors, both personal and historical. His so-called reckless enthusiasm for luxury was conspicuous, but hardly a very weighty matter. Of greater consequence was his inability to be a responsible manager of his financial affairs. Whenever he came into some money, if after paying off his debts something was left over, he spent it freely and, bohemian style, shared it with friends. The number of his creditors and benefactors is astonishing. Before King Ludwig, Wagner's most generous supporter was the German businessman Otto Wesendonck. More about him later. Wagner considered the loans he received with astonishing regularity as investments in his future earnings, a not unreasonable assumption on his part, but a frustrating attitude in the eyes of the creditors as long as the money-making potential of his operas looked dim. The chief factor in Wagner's poor economic circumstances was the inherent inequity of the structure of the music business in the 19th century. Before 1871, when a rudimentary copyright law was enacted in Germany, composers and other creative artists were grossly disadvantaged. In principle, Wagner could expect earnings in 3 ways: through the sale of scores to publishers, through the sale of transcriptions and adaptations, and through actual performances of his works. On all 3 counts, the composer received lump sums. For publications, he received no percentage of the publisher's profits. Had he lived half a century later, Wagner would have become even more of a millionaire than Richard Strauss and Giacomo Puccini combined. Ultimately, the reasons for making Wagner's financial dealings into a moral case and for faulting him for his behavior toward his creditors must be sought beyond the biographical facts and rather in his philosophical views. The creator of the Der Ring des Nibelungen held deeply anti-capitalist socialist convictions. Furthermore, during the 1849 uprising in Dresden, he fought shoulder to shoulder with Mikhail Bakunin, the famous Russian anarchist, for the overthrow of the existing social order. That such a man should be seen living in comfort and consorting with that most regressive Bavarian monarch was bound to cause envy and to provoke cries of hypocrisy and betrayal. We may fairly conclude, then, that those who turn up their noses at Wagner's financial dealings do so less because of his underhanded behavior with his creditors than because of the undeniable discrepancy between his political views and his personal practice. Still, of the 4 heads of the Wagnerian Hydra, the messiness of his financial affairs is surely the least repellent. The scandalous private life, to which I alluded earlier, concerns primarily Wagner's clumsily covered-up affair with Cosima von Bülow. When Wagner came to Munich at the behest of the king, he was estranged from his wife, Minna, He lived with Cosima and pretended, against all probability, that she was his private secretary, although this was indeed one of the offices that she did occupy. At the time, Cosima's husband, the brilliant conductor Hans von Bülow, was preparing the first performance of Tristan und Isolde at the Hofe Nationaltheater of the Bavarian capital. In a famous caricature, we see little Wagner walking on Munich's Maximilianstrasse, arm in arm with the towering Cosima, and followed three steps behind by Hans von Bülow. The conductor is carrying the weighty score of Tristan, one page of which, however, is falling to the ground. It is marked Marcus Lament, a pointed reference to King Marcus, the cuckolded husband in Tristan und Isolde. 3 years later, doggedly devoted to the Wagnerian cause, Bülow conducted the first performance of Die Meistersinger von Nürnberg. It was Wagner's greatest triumph ever. The emotional toll that this involuntary ménage à trois took on all concerned was enormous and cast a shadow over the remainder of their lives. By the time Wagner began to take notice of Cosima, who was the illegitimate daughter of Franz Liszt and a Wagner worshipper since her teenage years, his roller coaster marriage to Minna had been on the rocks for some time. Minna was, by all accounts, an attractive and sexy actress. She was 4 years older than he and had an illegitimate daughter from a previous affair, Natalia, whom they passed off as Minna's sister. As for Cosima, her marriage to Hans von Bülow, with whom she had 2 children, was also in decline. After the divorce from Bülow became official, Wagner and Cosima, now 57 and 32 respectively, were married in Lucerne in 1870. By that time, Cosima had borne Wagner 3 children, among them Siegfried, the heir to and future director of the Bayreuth Festival. Their marriage was the union of 2 deeply suffering and deadly serious people who needed each other. Cosima, out of an all-consuming need to worship and support a man of genius, Wagner, out of an all-encompassing need to share his life with a partner who was his intellectual equal, and he was ready, unconditionally, to help him to complete what he saw as his artistic and cultural mission. In light of their decidedly unfrivolous affair, it is hard to comprehend how Wagner acquired the reputation of a habitual predatory philanderer, interested preferably in other men's wives. As in the case of the financial dealings, we have to assume that certain parts of his operatic work have shaped perceptions of Wagner, the man, and have earned him the dubious distinction of an immoralist of some kind of Don Juan. There is no denying that that conventional marriage in several of Wagner's works is vilified as based on property rights rather than on love, and in none of his works do we find a happy marriage. Such consistent distrust and undermining was bound to rub off on the perception of the artist who was entertaining these thoughts. Wagner was a workaholic. As he confessed to one of his benefactors, a day without work is like a day in hell. Such a person has little time for philandering. Had he led the life of a dissolute Don Juan, he would have never found the time to accomplish what he in fact accomplished. Aside from Minna and Cosima, we need to take note of at least 3 other women who sailed into Wagner's orbit: Jessie, Mathilde, and Judith. Jessie Taylor was a rich English girl who was studying music and German in Dresden when, at a performance of Tannhäuser, she fell under the spell of Wagner's music. Soon thereafter, she was married off to a French wine merchant, Eugène Loiseau, and moved to Bordeaux. Wagner, still rattled by the failure of the Dresden uprising the previous year, and still without a permanent address, visited her in March of 1850, drawn to her in part by the prospect of a handsome annual allowance. While her husband was away on business, Jessie and Wagner progressed from the living room to the bedroom. A few weeks later, when the whole thing had blown over, Wagner explained to Julie Ritter, a friend of his and a confidant of Jesse's, that he and Jesse had, quote, dedicated ourselves to the God of love, and that he had tasted quote again, the heady intoxication of love. Giddily conceived plans to elope to Greece and to the Orient came to naught. Wagner barely escaped the wrath of Monsieur Loiseau, who was eager to blow his brains out. Realizing that Wagner had not been entirely honest when he told her that his marriage to Minna was over, Jessie terminated the affair. She proceeded to divorce Loiseau, her personal hunding, and later married the eminent historian and writer Karl Hillebrand, with whom she hosted for many years a famous literary salon in Florence. The episode with Mathilde Wiesendonck is the most celebrated and scrutinized in Wagner's love life. Mathilde was married to the aforementioned Otto Wiesendonck, who had made his fortune in the silk trade. He took early retirement and moved with his talented wife to Zurich, where he built a splendid villa and dedicated himself to the pleasant task of supporting the arts. An older house close to his property, the famous Asyl, became Minna and Richard's abode for 16 months of emotionally trying neighborliness. Otto had bought the house from a neurologist out of fear that it be converted into an insane asylum. Little did he know that the Asyl would soon be visited by a madness of a different order. Wagner fell in love with Mathilde, but while he regarded her as the love of his life, all signs are that he did not have sexual relations with that woman. Most likely, he thought of her as the greatest love of his life because he came to realize that the work he was in the process of creating, Tristan und Isolde, was going to be more daring and accomplished than anything he had ever done. The affair with Mathilde came to an end when Minna intercepted a particularly compromising letter from Wagner to his adorata. Forced to skip town because of the ensuing scandal, he went off to Venice and devoted himself to the composition of Tristan. Judith Gautier was the precocious and brilliant daughter of the French writer Théophile Gautier. Her nickname was L'Ouragan, the hurricane. She too had fallen under the spell of Wagner's music when she was 17. She married Catulle Mendès, an ardent French Wagnerian. In the summer of 1869, the two of them, accompanied by the novelist Villiers de L'Isle-Adam, paid Wagner a memorable 10-day visit in his Swiss refuge at Triebschen. The composer was delighted to see his young French admirers and was especially smitten by Judith's temperament and Mediterranean beauty. He spent much time with his visitors, horsing around with them on the property of his lakeside house, and, most unusually, played for them excerpts from his current work, Siegfried. 7 years later, in 1876, after Judith had divorced Mendès and taken up with an aspiring composer, Louis Benedictus, she went to Bayreuth unaccompanied to be present at the first Bayreuth festival. Wagner gave her a private tour of the Festspielhaus, and the two managed to meet secretly in the house that Judith had rented for the occasion. There, in Judith's embrace, Wagner found solace for the frustrations caused by the less-than-perfect way that the festival was turning out. Over the next 2 years, Wagner wrote amorous letters to her, begging her to provide him with satins, bathing lotions, and perfumes from Paris, as a poor but badly needed substitute for her corporeal presence. Viewed together, these most celebrated affairs of Richard Wagner reveal a clear pattern. The three women in question were all well-situated financially. They were all well-educated, artistically inclined, and eagerly receptive to the insinuating magic of his music. Finally, they were all good, even rapt listeners, this being perhaps the most important prerequisite for becoming a Wagnerian muse. In short, they were all exact opposites of Minna, who had become tiresome to him. He rationalized his separation from her, saying that she never understood that he could not live with his wings tied. It is hardly surprising that Wagner's three muses were much younger than he. Jesse and Mathilde by 15 years. When the 26-year-old Judith Gautier came to Bayreuth, Wagner was 63. The age gap was now 37. Only the relationship with Jesse seems to have been sexually consummated, which may be the reason for its short duration. In all three instances, the relationship was highly charged erotically, intended to arouse his sexual desire without necessarily satisfying it. Paradoxical though it may sound, the real goal of Wagner's extravagant emotional investments may in fact have been not reaching the goal. Ultimately, Wagner's muses fulfilled an instrumental role. They made his creative juices flow and imbued his creations with the very erotic charge that is one of the hallmarks of his music. No one exemplifies the Wagnerian muse more completely than Mathilde. For in this case, the muse herself was able to participate in the creative process, specifically the genesis of Tristan and Isolde. Mathilde used her powers to awaken Wagner's sexual desire and, by withholding gratification, led the composer to transform desire into music. She was indeed, as Chris Walton has put it, a controlling muse. It should be clear, then, that Wagner's record as a lover is in no way justifies the label Don Juan. No catalogue aria, such as the one we find in Mozart's opera, need to be sung to list his conquests. For Wagner, the fingers of one hand, or at the most two, will suffice. As Lawrence Dreyfus recently characterized him, Wagner was a, quote, reluctant if obsessive eroticist, and even something of a sexual coward. In the last analysis, and this is perhaps the most characteristic aspect of Wagner the lover, he allowed himself to be carried away only when the emotional economy of his creativity demanded it. He was an occasional, but by no means habitual, transgressor. If I were to substitute libation for infidelity, I would call Wagner a social drinker, but not an alcoholic. Given the historical distance that separates us from Richard Wagner and his times, it is easy to cast a cold, dispassionate eye on his amorous and financial adventures. But we cannot dismiss as a quantité négligeable Wagner's vilification of the Jew and his anti-Semitic agitation. In our post-Holocaust consciousness, the question of Wagner's anti-Semitism has acquired a special gravity that places it at the absolute hard core of the problem most people have with Wagner. Today, as a consequence, the subject of anti-Semitism practically monopolizes the debate about Wagner's historical legacy. Wagner's notoriety as a Jew hater rests primarily, though not exclusively, on his 1850 essay, Das Judentum in der Musik, meaning something like Judaism in music. With this article, published anonymously, Wagner joined an ongoing debate in France and Germany, partly triggered by the enormous success of Giacomo Meyerbeer, a German Jew who hailed from Berlin and who resided much of the time in Paris. In his article, which purports to be a dispassionate disquisition about Jewish taste in art, Wagner vents his frustration with the deplorable conditions of musical life, which he blames on the Jews and on capitalism. The pivotal point of Wagner's argument concerns the alleged inability of Jews, who are branded as aliens, to access the German Volksgeist, that mythical spirit and collective soul of the people, from which it was believed all great art draws its inspiration. Music by Jews was thus, by definition, eclectic, disorganized, and lacking in passion. Much later, in 1869, Wagner published Das Judentum in der Musik as a separate brochure, this time under his own name, with a new and lengthy preface. In 1850, it was clearly Meyerbeer and, to a lesser extent, Felix Mendelssohn who had provided the impetus for Wagner's article. In 1869, the advance of Jewish emancipation in the German lands and the Jewish reaction to the original publication in particular by the influential Viennese critic Eduard Hanslick, appears to have prompted Wagner to renew his attack. Hanslick's hostile review of the Meistersinger von Nürnberg seems to have been the straw that broke the camel's back. Here, in the 1869 version, for the first time, Wagner advocates what came to be termed a Judenreines Germany, to use the ominous terminology of the Nazis, as he speculates that ejection by force of the corrosive foreign element represented by Jewry may well be the best way to halt the decline of German culture. Is there anything persuasive at all that can efface this particular odious aspect of Wagner's character? The short answer is no. After all, in a letter to Franz Liszt of 1851, he confessed that he harbored a long suppressed resentment against this Jewish business, and this resentment is as necessary to my nature as gall is to the blood. But it should also be noted that Wagner, when he was asked in 1880 to sign a petition aimed at restricting the civil rights of Germans of the Mosaic faith, did see fit not to do so, for what reasons we do not know. Similarly, it should be acknowledged that he was not enough of a fanatic to abide by his own prescriptions. Troubling and embarrassing as his anti-Semitic pamphlet may be, it never became the Bible for Wagner's personal conduct. He worked with Jewish musicians and admitted many of them to his inner circle, among them the literary historian Samuel Leas, the Polish pianist Karl Tausig, the Russian pianist Joseph Rubinstein, the German conductor Hermann Levy, the Leipzig theater director Angelo Neumann, and the great soprano Lili Lehmann. Furthermore, beyond Bayreuth, Wagner enjoyed the reverence of a strikingly large number of Jews, including even that of Theodor Herzl, the founder of the Zionist movement. Richard Wagner thus stands before us as the paradoxical case of a Jew-hater worshipped by Jews. Due to the privileged place of music in German culture and to Wagner's privileged place in German music, there is no doubt whatsoever that his obsessive anti-Semitism carried a special cachet and was therefore emulated by many self-avowedly non-political German music lovers. The question that thoughtful observers must deal with, however, is the more subtle one of the extent to which, if at all, Wagner's personal anti-Jewish animus contaminated his operas. Indeed, nothing divides opera lovers and students of his work more sharply than this difficult question. As one might expect, the debate over the last three decades or so has led to the formation of two opposing camps. On the one side are what one might call the contaminationists, the critics and commentators who argue that, quote, hatred of Jewishness is the hidden agenda of virtually all the operas. And on the other side are the purists who assert that Wagner consciously kept his musical dramatic oeuvre free from anti-Semitic tendencies. Who is right? How can we decide? In my judgment, having grappled with the matter for many years, the question of the anti-Semitic import of Wagner's operas is so complex that I find unpersuasive the arguments on both sides of the divide. Since there are no Jewish figures in the operatic works, with the partial exception of Kundry in Parsifal, the analytical lens has to be trained on the evidence of subtexts and codes. Such subtexts do indeed appear to be woven into the portrayal of Alberich and Mime in The Ring, of Beckmesser in The Meistersinger, and of Kundry and Klingsor in Parsifal. All of these figures are losers, or, if you prefer, rejects who, according to Theodor Adorno's often cited observation, should all be understood as caricatures of Jews. Not only are there no overtly Jewish figures in the operas, but, and this adds to the complexity of the problem, there is no overtly political discourse either. As a rule, political ideas in the operas are elevated to a meta-political plane and elaborated in cultural terms. In this regard, Wagner's operas conform to the distinction made by the political theorist Constantin Franz, a Wagner admirer, who decreed that in order to be genuinely German, politics must be elevated to metapolitics. Metapolitics, he says, is to ordinary politics as metaphysics is to physics. Let me give you a few examples to show how this is meant. No political vocabulary is needed to project upon Alberich and Mime certain allegedly Jewish features, so long as they are consistently and stereotypically portrayed as dark, hostile, alien, deformed, greedy, and power-hungry. Nor do any proto-fascist statements need to be articulated if the people of Nuremberg, in the Meistersinger, are consistently presented as inhabiting not a clearly recognizable civic society, but rather a pre-modern corporate community foreshadowing what in the Third Reich was termed Volksgemeinschaft. Nor is it necessary, finally, to have Nuremberg's Hans Sachs expressly reject democratic principles if he is drawn as the very exemplar of a charismatic popular leader hailed by all. What these examples suggest is of crucial importance to an adequate understanding of the political ramifications of the German cult of Wagner. His impact in the long run derives far less from his overtly political pronouncements, including his anti-Semitic pamphlet, than from the metapolitical suggestiveness of his music dramas. It is their metapolitical dimension that accounts for their peculiarly proleptic quality, which is to say, their striking predisposition toward future appropriation. And appropriated they were during the 50-year period that led from Wagner's death to Hitler's assumption of the chancellorship, those very 5 decades when Wagner's star stood in its zenith may be rightly regarded as the incubation period of National Socialism in Germany. One final, and in my view, decisive point needs to be made about this whole vexing matter. It may at first seem that Wagner's anti-Semitism is the crucial factor that accounts for his deeply tainted reputation. To be sure, Wagner's hostility was of a particularly base sort. However, we know of other composers who held similarly unenlightened prejudices. Robert Schumann, for instance, Modest Mussorgsky, and Hugo Wolf, to name but a few. And we know of writers, Fyodor Dostoevsky is one, who said and wrote fiercely hostile things about the Jews. Why is their reputation not nearly as so tarnished as Wagner's? Nobody in Israel would think of boycotting them, whereas the unofficial ban on Wagner, despite growing calls for its termination, is still in force. Let us not kid ourselves. What accounts decisively for the uniquely problematical perception of Wagner today is the name, with all its sinister and nefarious associations, of Adolf Hitler. He is the big elephant in the room. Wagner is the artist that the German dictator revered the most. This becomes clear from his speeches and conversations, from his familiarity with the operas and with Wagner's biography, from his friendship with the descendants of Wagner, and from his massive and unstinting support of the Bayreuth Festival. Here we are confronted with a truly fateful concatenation of politics and the arts. One of the results of the debates about the Holocaust is, in the words of Saul Friedlander, the definition of Hitler as, quote, the ultimate standard of evil against which all degrees of evil may be measured. The implications of this statement, not only for the study of Wagner, but of all of German culture, are far-reaching, because everything that Hitler touched has come to bear an indelible stain and to be regarded as irremediably suspect. Nothing more so than what he revered the most. Will the yoke that links Wagner to Hitler last forever? This is a question that troubles all thoughtful Wagnerians a great deal. The only way, in my view, to move beyond an apparently positive answer to this question is to re-examine how this yoke came about. In order to understand how the Hitler-Wagner nexus came about, we need to have a firm grasp of what is commonly called influence. Many biographers and historians have attempted to define the nature of the Hitler-Wagner nexus by positing the so-called influence of the operas and essays on Hitler's political thinking. One such historian views Hitler as the willing executioner of the promptings of an evil magician, and Wagner himself as the prophet of both National Socialism and the Holocaust. Here, in order to avoid confusion, we must clearly distinguish between two related but different phenomena, influence and appropriation. What we loosely call influence is in fact a fairly complicated intellectual transaction that in most cases should more accurately be defined as appropriation. When someone appropriates an idea, he will unavoidably bend it, consciously or more often unconsciously, to his very specific needs. Thus, when we speak of influence, we emphasize the primacy of the source of the influence. When we speak of appropriation, as we must in the case of Hitler and Wagner, we emphasize the primacy of the appropriator. Any shading or distortion of the idea that has been appropriated is thus the responsibility of the appropriator. It does not speak for the hypothesis of an influence that Hitler, as recent studies have shown, never once invoked the example of Wagner's anti-Semitism in order to justify his own. He could easily have said that if our great Richard Wagner called for the elimination of the Jews from Germany, then our anti-Jewish laws and policies simply follow through on what Wagner called for. Of course, there was no need for him to pontificate about Wagner's anti-Jewish position because that was a well-known fact. Perhaps he deliberately refrained from belaboring this point because he knew his idol all too well. Wagner's own rejection of the Jewish presence in German culture was not nearly so radical as his own, because both in Wagner's pamphlet and in Parsifal, he allows for the possibility of redemption. If Hitler can therefore not be regarded as Wagner's disciple, how are we to categorize such a conspicuous but murky connection? From a look at the whole trajectory of his involvement with Wagner, we can see that Hitler's ambition in the end was to lead the nation in a metapolitical cult of Wagner's genius. It would appear that he disdained exploiting Wagner to justify his anti-Jewish agenda because he needed him for another, more exalted purpose, namely to legitimize in cultural terms Germany's claim to political domination. The pervasive Nazi cult of genius was rooted in the conviction that the so-called Aryan race was uniquely capable of producing genius and that therein lay its claim to superiority, especially over the Jewish race. The global success of Wagnerian music was thought to have demonstrated the superiority of German culture as a whole. It had thereby underlined the Aryan race's right to domination, the Nazis argued, and ultimately legitimized the aggressive hegemonic aspirations of the Third Reich. To Hitler, as to almost all his contemporaries, Wagner was not primarily an intellectual authority, but rather the embodiment of an aesthetic experience. The Führer formed much of his vaunted Weltanschauung not by studying Wagner's theoretical writings, but by going to the opera, initially in Linz, later in Vienna. He saw Lohengrin at age 12, and the opera remained a favorite for life. At age 15, he saw Rienzi, Wagner's most overtly political, some have argued proto-fascist, opera. The tragic story of the charismatic medieval leader who attempts to restore Rome to its former glory and greatness sent the impressionable youth into ecstasy. The impact was that of an epiphany. Henceforth, this opera colonized his mind and helped shape his budding political sensibility. By the time Hitler visited Wahnfried for the first time on October 1, 1923, he had internalized another Wagnerian figure, Wotan, the chief of the guards in the ring. He must have found it particularly appealing to imagine Wotan during the 20 years or so that go by in the operatic fiction between the end of Das Rheingold and the beginning of Die Walküre. That is the crucial early stage of Wotan's career as a ruler, when he roams the earth with his son Wewald, later named Siegmund, and coaches him to become a great hero prepared to ward off the mortal danger posed by Alberich and his legions. At that stage of the music drama, Wotan was known as Wolf. This is precisely the nickname by which Hitler was known in the intimate circle of the Wagner family at Wahnfried. To Wagner's four grandchildren, Hitler was simply Uncle Wolf. It seems entirely plausible, therefore, that during his own years of struggle, the political dark horse on the German political scene fancied himself as Wagnerian, as a Wagnerian Wolf. If Rienzi and Wotan were fundamental to Hitler's Wagnerian self-fashioning, which is to say his identity formation on the psychological level, then Parsifal, Wagner's ultimate work and metapolitical testament, completed his formation as a pernicious über-Wagnerian. But unlike Rienzi and Wotan, the character of Parsifal seems not to have shaped Hitler's self-understanding. The role of Parsifal the Redeemer was rather assigned to Hitler by none other than the intellectual leader of the Bayreuth Circle, Houston Stuart Chamberlain. After Hitler's first visit to Wahnfried in 1923, he was given, in an open letter, a ringing endorsement from Chamberlain and Winifred Wagner, the first such recognition the political upstart received from a respected cultural institution. In a follow-up message, the ailing Chamberlain let it be known that he was comforted in his agony by the knowledge that a new Parsifal had appeared on the scene. Quote, "In the hour of her greatest need, Germany has given birth to someone like Hitler." 1924, this. Like Wagner's Parsifal, Hitler is called upon to perform the Heiltat, the healing deed, this time not for the Knights of the Grail, but for Germany itself. The new Parsifal's mission is to rid Germany of the lethal influence of the Jews. Chamberlain pointed out to the faithful that many people wished the Jews would disappear, but that no one had the determination to carry out this necessary task. No one except Adolf Hitler. With that, Hitler was anointed the new Parsifal. On this image from Bayreuth, the shrine of the Wagner cult, with Hitler imbued with his Wagnerian imaginings and now basking in the approval of Wagner's son-in-law, I draw the curtain. I hope from what I have said that you will agree that Tomasini's term jerk, which served as my launching pad, is woefully inadequate. Wagner presents a problem that historians are still struggling to explain, and it's a problem that won't go away anytime soon. I thank you for your attention.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Faget, for that very fascinating talk. It reminded me, especially at the end, of one of my favorite totally anonymous quotations, which is, "An idea is not responsible for the people who believe in it." So, it's ready for questions. Anybody would like to ask the first one? It can come up to the mics. Who would like to come up to the mic first? Anybody? Okay, great. Go right ahead.
I once heard that during World War II, one of Wagner's great granddaughters spent a lot of time doing propaganda broadcasts to Nazi Germany, saying why her great grandfather would have hated Hitler and the Nazis. Do you have any comments on that?
Yes, you are referring to Friedelin Wagner, who was the second of Wagner's four grandchildren. She had a disagreement with her English-born mother, Winifred, who was an enthusiastic Hitler fan, and that got to the point where she fled Germany. And even in the face of threats that she would be eliminated, she remained outside of Germany, became a friend of Toscanini, and then lived for a time in London and in New York, and was one of the, not the only one, she was probably the most conspicuous anti-Nazi member of the Wagner family. The other one being Wagner's very first grandson, whom nobody knows, Franz Beidler. He was married to a Jewish woman, and he too was in the anti-Nazi camp. So, the generalization that you often encounter in the literature, namely that all Wagner descendants of Wagner were Nazis, is not true.
You mentioned two questions. You mentioned that people who write about or consider Wagner either very pro or very con. Is there any biography that is sort of middle of the road and even-handed with regards to Wagner that you would recommend?
The answer to that, my instinctive answer to that would be yes, the great four-volume biography by Ernest Newman. The trouble with that is that that book was written in the 30s and early 40s of the 20th century. So the passions that you now find in the discussion about Wagner is absent. The great thing about Newman is that he corrects a lot of myths and a lot of false exculpatory statements coming out of Bayreuth, and it's still a delight to read. It's very it's written at a very leisurely pace with lots of details. But you have to, if you go to that source, you have to bear in mind it was written in the 30s and 40s. We now know more about Wagner than Newman did, and the heat of the discussion has increased considerably.
Second question is, that having just seen The Ring, one of the things that impressed me in regards to the story figures is that starting with Wotan and Sigmund and Siegfried and Albrecht and all of the other males in this story seem to be either somewhat losers or evil or negative in much of their presentation. And as we get down to the finality of Gerda Dammerung, everybody on the stage, all the heroines, are females.
Mm-hmm.
Would you comment on that?
this is an obvious point to make, and it also conforms with the concept that seems to be underlying the current production here in San Francisco by Francesca Zambello, who has developed not only an American reading of The Ring, but also a feminist reading of The Ring. I happen to agree with it because the last essay that Wagner was working on in Venice before he died was entitled About the Feminine in the Human. And this is just the tip of the iceberg. May be taken as an indication that all his life, in his writings, in his theoretical writings, and in his operas, he had the he followed his instinct that somehow the female part of humanity is superior in terms of humanity, and that if there's any hope for rescuing the awful mess that men like Wotan and others have and Alberich have created, then that hope can only come from someone like Sieglinde. In my reading of The Ring, Sieglinde is key because Sieglinde's, the love that that rises up between Sieglinde and Siegmund in the first scene of Die Walküre, that kind of love is uncompromised by what Alberich and Wotan did so far in the ring, and that all hope will arise, will rest in that type of love, love that is based on compassion and an instinctive solidarity with suffering, and not on any calculations, any other ulterior motives. And it is Brünnhilde at the end who stands before us as the heir of the kind of love that was created or that came into existence spontaneously between Siegmund and Sieglinde.
Yes, I'd like to ask two questions. First, are any characters in the Wagnerian music dramas or in opera in general who are deceitful, avaricious, not to be trusted, and the like, are they necessarily Jewish? And the second question is, what do we make of Hitler's great love for the music of Franz Lehár, who was alive, of course, when Hitler was alive, and he was married to a Jewish woman?
Yes, there are characters in Wagner's operas that are deceitful. Two of them are in the ring, Alberich and Mime. And one of them is in Die Meistersinger, poor Beckmesser. And I think I was trying to make clear in my talk that they not necessarily have to be perceived as caricatures of Jews, but that because of the way the text and the music are coded, it is easy to construct an anti-Jewish agenda. But that would then be the responsibility of the interpreter. I have seen plenty of Wagner productions in which all suggestion or traces of an anti-Jewish agenda were totally absent. I've seen productions in which the characters I've named were portrayed as caricatures of Jews, but it was not done in order to open the audience's eyes to this obvious fact, but in order to denounce Wagner as an evil anti-Semite.
Hi, can you comment on Wagner's opinion of other nationalists?
I'm sorry, I have not answered the gentleman's. Franz Lehár. I don't take that. I mean, everybody loves Franz Lehár. Even I do too. Franz Lehár did not have an unencumbered career in the Third Reich because of his because he was married to a Jewish woman. But there is no doubt that as far as the identity formation of young Hitler is concerned, Wagner is the decisive aesthetic experience and not Franz Lehár.
Can you comment on Wagner's opinion of nationalities and religious groups that were non-German and non-Aryan? You've commented, and it's fairly well known how he felt about the Jews. How did he feel about other nationalities and other religious groups?
He was middle of the road, that is to say. He acted just the way Goethe described it in Faust, that every true German hates the French, but they love to drink their wines. He did have a lot of prejudices against the French. He loved being in Paris, but he didn't like the suffering that went, at least in the the first 3 years he spent in Paris. But like any thinking person, he was attracted to Paris. It was the capital of the world at the time, at least in cultural terms. He loved Italy, but he said a lot of stupid things about Italian culture because he was reading Italian culture through the lens of Romantic, German Romantic aesthetics, with all this mumbo-jumbo about Volksgeist, etc., he projected it onto Italy, and in most cases he was simply off. He did not like certain aspects of Italian musical culture, but he was a great admirer of Rossini and of Bellini, thank you, yeah. He had great reservations vis-a-vis Verdi, which makes him look really bad because Verdi was very magnanimous in his comments about Wagner. I'm not aware of any substantive comments about the Slavic people or Russians. I can't answer that. I'm sorry.
Unfortunately, we only have time for one more question.
Yes. Given the antisemitism and the link to Hitler, how do you interpret and understand the continued enthusiasm for Wagner's work, and how do you personally deal with that conflict in enjoying the music?
If it is a conflict, I'm not aware of it. I feel stimulated by the music, not just in the ordinary sense of liking to listening to it. I feel stimulated by the challenge of making sense of it all in the historical and cultural context that this work in which this work was created. It is a challenge to any cultural historian to make sense of Wagner and of the afterlife of Wagner, particularly in Germany, but not only in Germany, because Wagner had a tremendous impact in France, as we all know, in Italy, but also in the United States, where the perception of Wagner was shaped by completely different intellectual and psychological priorities. It's an endlessly fascinating topic.
It's a great way to end. An endlessly fascinating topic, yeah. That should have made more fascinating. So ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 108th year of enlightened discussion.